You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, created by Mark and JP Morris, executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomas on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO. 2 hours of global bass with an emphasis on South Asia and the South Asian diaspora, and an even more special emphasis on the Punjabi diaspora. Hosted every Tuesday, 10 to midnight, by The Incredible Kid. This ain't world music, it's birth of a new world music.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starved to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition, but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, July 28th at 10 a.m. on 90.7 KBOO FM. If you love animals, and especially dogs, don't miss it.
Rise them up, KBOO 90.7. You don't know it's your girl, Tasha T.
To listen to the extended version of this episode, support us on patreon.com/forthewild.
But the climate crisis and the extinction crisis, it has disrupted those cycles of regeneration, right? So the solace and the stories that tell us that we regenerate, that life comes from death, that's being interrupted. That's the grief that I find inconsolable.
That grief, as you said, is not in the way. Grief is the way. No, to transformation is the way that we can let go and then be open to the mystery, be open to spirit to really flow through. And no matter what, the animating principle of life will flow through.
For the Wild is honored to present The Edges in the Middle, a series of conversations between Bayo Komolafe,
and thought companions like John A. Powell, V, Naomi Klein, and more. These limited episodes have been adapted from Bio's work as the Global Senior Fellow at UC Berkeley's Othering and Belonging Institute. In this role, Bio has been holding a series of public conversations on issues of justice and belonging for the Institute's Democracy and Belonging Forum, which connects and resources civic leaders in Europe and the US who are committed to bridging across differences to strengthen democracy and advance belonging in both regions and around the world. Bio's conversations encourage us to rethink justice, hope, and belonging by sitting amidst the noise, not trying to cover it up with pleasant rhythms. To learn more about the Democracy and Belonging Forum, visit democracyandbelongingforum.org. This recording features Bio's conversation with celebrated climate activist Naomi Klein and Indigenous scholar Dr. Uriah Seledwin. Naomi Klein is an award-winning journalist, columnist, and international best-selling author of 8 books, including No Logo, The Shock Doctrine, This Changes Everything, and On Fire, which has been translated into over 35 languages. In September 2021, she joined the University of British Columbia as UBC Professor of Climate Justice and is also the founding co-director of the UBC Center for Climate Justice. Uriah Seledwin is a senior fellow at the Othering and Belonging Institute. She's a native of Indigenous Nahua and Maya descent, born into a family of mystics, healers, poets, and explorers from the highlands of Chiapas, Mexico. She teaches Indigenous epistemologies and spirituality, and her work pioneered the Indigenous contemplative experience within contemplative studies. Together, Naomi, Uriah, and Bio explore climate grief and hope.
Welcome to everyone joining us from wherever you are in the world. Thank you for being part of these conversations and these explorations in times of crises. This is perhaps the most difficult of the series that I will be taking part in. This one about climate grief and hope is very dear to me. So we're going to have a substantial and spontaneous conversation together with my other sisters today. So difficult because I'm at home with my kids alone. So I would like everyone to know beforehand that if you see my son or my daughter bursting through that door, please acknowledge or celebrate the moment to the extraordinary ordinariness of that moment. But let me start by saying a few things, as I usually do, about Umbaris. The context of our conversation is such that we are not after some convenient consensus. An Umbari is an Igbo cosmological tool, a way of thinking about the world, our bodies, and our relationality with truth. If you want to know in depth or with some depth about this idea of conversation, then I would invite you to check out the web pages of the Democracy and Belonging Forum and OBI as well. I think it might be necessary to say that we are not after some final proposal. We are here to gesture together. In fact, truth is not the final boss stop here. There is no finality that is not already penultimate. The world flows and moves and dances and is promiscuous, so that the invitation here is to meet each other and be changed by the encounter. It's not even to get it. It's not even to, you know, grasp something final. It's to just stay with the trouble of our moving bodies. It's to postpone the myth of the individual long enough to sense other realities. And I think that's a beautiful way of segueing into the context of this conversation, climate, grief, and hope. As you might know, if you're here, the IPCC report in March, released in March, the sixth iteration, was a story of loss and a story of demise. It seems to be the most powerful modern narrative gripping the heart of civilization. The idea that if we don't get our act together, we might breach that global threshold of a change in degrees of 1.5 degrees Celsius or Celsius degrees. And if we do that, then we would have entered unprecedented times. Floods everywhere, ocean acidification, famine, hunger, pain, suffering. I come from those worlds. And our conversation here today is to stay with it in a different way. One symptom of that prognosis, that story, one outcome has been grief. So I thought we could start by, and again, this is not going to be centered around my questions. I thought we could just do something different and pass along with each other things that are emerging for us. But my first prompt to get things started is if we can share stories of loss to open us to the energies of this space together. Are there accounts and narratives of loss that are significant to you in this time of metaphysical loss? Any of you could respond and then we take it together. This is the invitation. Okay, I'll just pass the mic literally to my dear sister, Yuria.
Lectalise Bameyes, Bintia Willelik, Ukala Walik, you own the Bible Hunter, you own the Talise. This is my indigenous Maya Chavdan language, and with it, I am honoring my lineage of the Nahuan Maya Chavdan peoples of the highlands of Chiapas in Mexico, where I was born and raised. My background is precisely that picture of that place of wonderlands of flowing waters, the land of Quelha. It was how our lands were named before they were taken from us. And I speak these languages also in honor of the Huichin and Ohlone tribes, where I am standing today as I honor ancestors. And also to remind us that these ancestors that I speak about are not only our lineage, human lineage, but our ancestors as our Mother Earth, our Father Sky, about oceans, our corals, our forests, all of these relatives that are guiding our right action today. And that will be also how resilient we can be when the weaving, the web of that network of ancestors, both from the past into the present, and also those emerging ancestors that are coming from what will be, are orienting our action today, our collective action today. We are not these separated beings. We are weaved beings connected into our lands, into our breaths, into all of our relatives, four-legged, winged, myceliated, rooted, finned, all these relatives with whom we shared this planet, our Mother Earth. But we see that there's so much loss happening today. It's not only the biodiversity loss that we are experiencing, the massive extinction, but the cultural loss that correlates with that biodiversity loss. The indigenous languages is just one way in we can see that this loss is happening, threatening our diverse possibilities for finding solutions together. So speaking my language is a way of bringing that diversity, that cultural array of possibilities together. And I will continue weaving into how loss also can bring meaning today, weaving stories of hope. Stay still, our sister Naomi. Good to see you as well.
I appreciate, Bio, what you said about expertise, because I'm certainly not expert in these types of conversations. I'm trained as a journalist. I'm a very fact-backed person. And I've sort of reached the limit of that particular model of, well, if we can just prove it enough, you know, you mentioned the IPCC report. And of course, all of us have had relationships with the academy. And the whole premise of the thing is, well, if we can just prove it, right? And we stack up the facts and the proof. If you have robust enough data sets, then the policy will change. So the work that I've been doing at the university has been really trying to work with young scientists who are still in graduate school and probably got into this work because they love the natural world. They're connected. A lot of folks tend to be less socially comfortable and more in their bodies when they are in the natural world. And yet they find themselves kind of acting as undertakers, right? Of collecting the data of loss, the evidence of extinction, with no outlet, with no acceptable way to feel it, right? In fact, you're supposed to turn it off. So we've been working on different kind of pedagogical models, which is just a fancy way of saying being in our feelings and reading powerful writing and letting it change us and trying our hand at it. But you asked to speak to a feeling of loss and an experience of loss, and I want to acknowledge them. I live in a place that is called, in Western European recent history, the quote-unquote Sunshine Coast, not very sunny, except for a couple months of the year. It's mostly rainy. It's a temperate rainforest, but it's been so dry in recent years that we're tipping away from being a rainforest at all. And it's salmon country, and it's also a graveyard. It's also a place of genocide. And the lands where I am are the lands of the Kushab people. And people of me remember this very, very shocking to non-Indigenous people news that the interior of British Columbia, 2 hours from here, graves and children were found. And other nations began a process of confirming their own stories. They knew that the graves were there at the sites of the former so-called residential schools. I say so-called because their goal was not education. Their goal was extinguishing Indigenousness, as Virio was speaking about, that tremendous cultural assassination, really, attempted. But just 15 minutes from here, a week ago, the Shishat Nation confirmed the presence of 40 children, as they said. These are not remains, these are children. So the loss is very heavy in the lands here. And it's also a time of rebirth. It's spring. It feels so precarious. Every bird song, every animal sighting, we just don't know what's next because we're part of an ecosystem where the salmon a little bit south of us in California and Oregon are not coming back. And so everybody is wondering what the future holds. My father went fishing 2 days ago and came back and said, not a bite. And it isn't just like a bad fishing trip. Right? It's like, what does this mean? I haven't seen a seal in months. I used to see them all the time. What does that mean? I don't know. It could be nothing. It could be back later today. But it's that feeling of being on a knife's edge, feeling that a lot.
I like to weave into that the story that Sister Naomi just brought, how the moments that we face loss, and we really embody the grieving process, is the total moment of surrendering, like realizing that that arrogance that keeps humans in a hierarchical organization, feeling that they are somehow exceptional and different from all others, that arrogance dissolves the moment that we realize we are powerless, really, to the process of life, you know, to the process of spirit, the process of nature. That idea of bringing not only the possibilities of the mysterious, right, the possibilities of the stories, that not everything can be measured as Western science says, but rather as how Indigenous sciences speaks about what we don't know, what we can't know, and how we can make meaning of precisely that unknowing and resting in that unknowing by finding the right insight to the action that we need to do as that collective, right?
Really struck, Yuria, that you said that grief is surrender, because right before I was making a couple of notes thinking about why so many people I know in the climate movement, in the climate justice movement, including, are afraid of grief. And I wrote down just now, it's because they equate grief with surrender, right? But what I meant was political surrender, right? That there's a fear that if we really open the door, well, if we fall down, we'll never get up, right? And that if we let ourselves feel the depths of the loss, the depths of the fear, that we'll just somehow never be able to be galvanized again. And it's the opposite, really, that grief is uncontainable, right? Including that surrender. But I work with these students I mentioned, you know, it's not a course on climate anxiety or climate grief. It's a course on climate feelings. And that's the first thing I say is like, it can be rage, it can be loss, it can be hope, it can be homesickness, there's so many emotions. And why do we prescribe just this one? But the main thing I want is just feel anything, like feel it a lot, you know? Because I feel like what is the source of the hopelessness or despair, those are legitimate emotions, but it's a deadeningness, really. That is what I'm most afraid of in myself and in the people I work with. It's just not feeling, somehow turning off and losing access to sources of strength and rebound and propulsive force. Anything at all.
Yeah, and absolutely. We know that emotions, especially strong emotions, right? Maybe we can start moving beyond the duality of positive and negative emotions. They're just emotions, right? And emotions, as we know from recent great research of emotional science, of how much these are ways that we appraise our behavior and that orient our actions, right? So we use these emotions as compass, the moral compass, to then create our pathways. But then again, I return to the need of creating these pathways together, mm-hmm. right? Especially bringing those communities that have not had the platform for being participants in decision making, but whose lives are mostly impacted by the changes that we're seeing right now, you know, by the losses that we're seeing right now. So it's a process of surrendering of the power, right, of the being in them, the power of control. That's what I say, you know, of like coming together to finding solutions.
Get this thing closely, now see it out of frame. Let it burn inside your baby, don't give it a name. The name is a thousand ways to erase that which you gaze upon so lovingly. So hard it'll stream away from you. Let it go and it comes back to you.
I just came back from Massachusetts and I was with some persons that had been part of the writing of that report. And I had a conversation with a scientist, a climate scientist, who told me, or who put to words something I started to experience around that time. And it's this mask. I don't know how else to describe it except to say it's a mask. It's a mask of forced hope. Let me put it that way. It's like the idea is these persons I was having conversations with, they seem to have this, I cannot let, Naomi, just like you were saying, I cannot fall. I cannot let this crack become wider. The breach will be too overwhelming. So I need to say to you all who were not part of that report writing process, that ritual, I need to say that everything will be fine. Even though I don't quite believe it myself, but everything will be fine. there was a sense in which hope was becoming a carceral thing, right? Incarcerating their bodies and blocking them from accessing certain other frameworks of responsivity, of responsibility. Is there a sense for both of you that we are going around in circles? Is there a sense we're trapped? Do you have that feeling that we are trapped? We're stuck.
Let me respond to the idea of the circles and bring actually the symbol, the very common indigenous symbol of the spiral, which we keep coming back to a similar place, but somehow
something's shifted.
Things have shifted. Things has moved, you know, and continues to be transformed depending on what our insights and our behaviors are. And another thing that I really want to mention, today in the Maya calendar is the day Wuxi'imi. And Wuxi'imi translates to seven death rebirth. And so the power of that is that how Shimi, which is the death rebirth, it's the process of composting, right? There is a moment in which, in order to change, we need to let go, we need to surrender, that we can let go of all of those stories that keep us separated, alienated, not even realizing that we ourselves are nature. You know, we are natural beings, part of this webbing of life. And so how can we then compose of those stories? But then with intentional participation, participation that brings all these different voices, all these different origin stories, we can recreate new collective stories of belonging, of kindness, of awe and sacredness, that we can then truly build a sense of reverence for the whole of Mother Earth. And that allows us to then die, you know, let death do the process, but knowing that that composting is to give rise to new forms of life. Forms of life that are emerging, right? That are transitioning for a story of belonging, right? So that's the rebirth. That's the reemergence. And that's the hope.
So cartographical in some sense, not a bus stop, not a terminal point.
The continuation, exactly.
Yes.
The continuation.
Please go ahead, sister.
So we are not trapped. If anything, perhaps trapped only in stories of impossibility. But I love saying that dreaming is the chrysalis of hope, where time without time is unleashed when we set ourselves free.
Thank you, sister. I'm going to hold this some great tension with whatever Naomi is about to say.
Well, I guess I was thinking about this, you know, what is, I love the phrase hope as a carceral thing, because, you know, I have often felt that you're ordered to have hope sometimes.
You're ordered to have hope.
If you're a public person, right, there's a sense of you must perform hope for others. You know, in my own experience, I used to be somebody who did that a lot. I would go out there and perform hope. And, you know, I made myself a promise, as Yuri has been reminding us, and as you said in your opening bio, I mean, we are a web, right? So when we put an energy into it, it changes it. And so I have been experimenting with shutting up a lot more because I am in that state and I don't want to beat myself up. But I also feel a responsibility not to tell other people that they need to come with me there. I will say, I need to not be afraid of them. But that to me is different than kind of being an evangelist, hopelessness. Yes. I will not do that. That's where I draw the line. But in terms of what the stuckness is, you know, I think a lot of it is these narrative structures that are encoded from the Old Testament, the New Testament, Hollywood action movies, right, that tell us not necessarily that we're doomed, but that we are going to get saved at the very, very last minute, right? Not all of us, the chosen ones, just the good ones.
Probably you too. Definitely not me.
Yeah, probably we are not too.
Definitely not.
That is the prison too, that story structure, because I'm so much more afraid of cruelty than I am of death, of how we treat one another when we fall down. What do? We hold each other, or do we fight each other? I mean, what? We kill each other? What do we do when we fall, right? Is there a way to fall with grace and love and to catch one another, right? That's what scares me, as we all know, because we're seeing so much evidence of stabbing one another as we fall. And that's such a mythological image, right? I love the film Don't Look Up, by the way. I know it was controversial, but what I loved about it was that it played with the Hollywood trope of we're going to get saved at the last minute. I was just like, no, we're not. It's going to hit. I just thought that was so cool.
Well, I like the film too, Don't Look Up. But to use that as a springboard to something else, there is a sense in which we are looking up. We are the posture that comes with white stability. I feel like even hope as presented within modernity is this shiny thing, right? It's shorn of its prickly edges. But in my traditions, hope is a trickster, right? There isn't a binary between hope and hopelessness. To hold hope well is to hold hopelessness, is to embrace it, is to know that things may not go out our way, right? And that is the beauty of this poetic saga that we call reality. But I'm speaking too much.
There's always not enough. But I bring both of your ideas of loss and grief and the push for fleeting, hyper-aroused state of hope. And then how that bridges into rituals of meaning. Thinking of, it is precisely the not knowing what's going to lead the way to our right action. Those stories of the paternalistic savior that comes in the end and saves the show, those ideas keeps us not only disempowered, but keeps us also in ignorance. And Sister Naomi was saying, what's the fear that is causing these problems? And in my case, I fear ignorance, right? Because that's what keeps us perpetuating systems without knowing that we are part of those problems. So without having a deep reflection, a deep contemplation into which is our part, that we continue this old narratives that need to be composted, then things will not change. And by your brother, you asked, are there other stories? Mm-hmm. There are so many stories, 7,000 different languages spoken in the world, each of which will have an origin story about who we are and how we got connected. Many of those stories we haven't heard, and we are losing those stories every day. So how do we create now platforms of belonging, of all those different stories, in which then we can find meaning, right? Meaning for new ways of identifying ourselves, stop or letting go of those, what keeps us stuck in narratives of isolation or domination or ownership or control, and rather weave into narratives of belonging to the earth, of reciprocity, you know, of returning, and all of these many other ways, you know, that we haven't yet heard.
I think we want to speak to that a little more. I would like us to shift the arrangement of our conversation, and I'm trying something new here, and I'm going to shift the baton, so to speak, around so we can ask each other questions. Okay, but for now, could we just, without time a bowl, just spiral out of this idea that grieving is not, and I think we need people to hear this, grieving is not in the way. Grieving together, falling apart together, might very well be the most ecstatic, the most animated politics in response to these moments that we can muster? Because yes, is there also something to be said about through your experiences and your scholarship and your own dreaming and your own experiences of loss, that let's stay with this crack, there is life here.
I love of seeing grief as ecstasy. I love of this power, the power of this image. Grief is the state of loss, right? And loss of some part of our identity that has been severed. Either our worldviews or someone we love or some sense of stability is lost. And we grieve. So we find ourselves out of our usual state of self. So it is ecstatic in that sense.
Yes.
It pushes us outside of our current normal state of mind into an in-between state, a kind of dream-like state in which things can happen. Possibilities can arise that we don't know because we surrender, right? Because we can rest in that unknowing. And that's the place of possibility. That's the place of potentiality. In so many origin stories that we find in indigenous traditions, the beginning of the world is a state of potentiality. It's a state of soup, cosmic soup, in which everything is resting. And little by little, some order starts arising. But that place of chaos, again, is the place of potential. It's a place pregnant of possibilities and opportunities. But then, of course, no pathway is set. Yes. Everything can be. So that's the unknown. But to be there is to let go of knowing, let go of having the solution, right? Is letting go of the identity, letting go of the narrative, the collective, the individual, and then transitioning into the place of communitas, you know, like in ritual processes. And I'm thinking right now of specific funerary rites, for example. You know? You start in a place of loss and grief, and you enter in the place of in-between, the place of communitas, right? In which the whole collective helps the griever, the bereaver, into finding meaning of this new identity that is rising, that is yet to be found, yet to be found meaning in, and then eventually able to return with a new sense of self, a new sense of responsibility, a new sense of place and belonging, not only to its own, but to the community when it stands, and then with the larger community of things, right? So then that grief, as you said, is not in the way. Grief is the way, you know, to transformation. Is the way that we can let go and then be open to the mystery, be open to spirit to really flow through. And no matter what, the animating principle of life, which is spirit, will flow through.
I'm really struck by your description of grief as ecstasy. And it just made me think that there really is nothing more intimate than grieving with someone, and the trust and the surrender of like my own experience of grief and collective grief is that it is a space of regeneration. And this feeling, I'm sorry to use a fossil fuel metaphor, but that so many of our social movements are running on empty. They're feeling isolated. You know, my question for both of you is something I've been struggling with around, you know, I mentioned I live in a temperate rainforest. These forests are filled with mother trees, right? These trees that are composting into the earth and are the spaces of most intense life, right? It's just very visual in my brain where I walk the dog, you know, I'm surrounded by the power of death as a life force. And I take a lot of solace and metaphorical strength from that. But like I said, you know, we had a drought that lasted so long that the forest stopped having that power. And I just feel like it's worth naming that thinking about the climate crisis and the extinction crisis, and I'm not using the word we because we are not all responsible for it, and there's so much erasure in that idea, but we are all in it. Mm-hmm. And it has disrupted those cycles of regeneration, right? So the solace and the stories that tell us that we regenerate, that life comes from death, that's being interrupted. That's the grief that I find inconsolable.
Right.
And, you know, I think, you know, there's so much discourse around how young people are on the front lines of the climate crisis. And of course they are, because they are going to be living with this longer. But to me, there's nothing sadder than being an elder, being at the end of one's life and knowing and not having the comfort that, yes, I'm leaving, but the systems are bigger than me and they are regenerating.
Right.
So how do you carry that? Because these cycles seem to not, like this thing called the Anthropocene has messed that up. And so, you know, I know this wonderful oceanographer who spent his life studying the Great Barrier Reef, and he's at the end of his life, and I see in him this inability to just pass the baton and know that the cycle is going to continue, right? Because it's not.
I would bring us back. Brother Baya started our conversation today inviting us to a place of shared vulnerability. And I think that place of unknowing is where vulnerability dwells. Not knowing really what will happen. There is a process called the nekia, from nekis, like corpse. And it is the journey through the underworld or the land of the dead. And that also is present in origin stories or traditions all over the world, in which there is that ritual process of losing the whole world, the whole identity, and finding oneself in a place of total vulnerability. We are right now in a global nekia in which we don't know. And not knowing is the moment where we really find ourselves in the possibility of coming together for solutions. I cringe a little bit with the idea of the Anthropocene, because we need to name the wideness of that term, the wideness of the Anthropocene. Because it's not about humanity being in Mother Earth. That has happened for millennia with quite good balance. It's rather the colonial imposition of control, ownership, transaction that has created this abuse towards each other and Mother Earth. So that part is what needs to be really deeply acknowledged, deeply reckoned with, and then moving to those reparations that need to happen so the solutions then start happening. Before that, we will just continue with the same old, same old, same old. You said it, Sister Nomi. Yes, the whole global south has not been responsible of the situation of the world, but we now know as well that the move towards mimicking Western lifestyles continues this, right? So we need to start shifting those stories We need to start moving beyond that. And even also the realization, you know, speaking now of the conservation movements, you know, the green economies, that are taking then again the personality of the Western individualist ideologies. That is only banking systems that are being benefited by carbon offsetting, and that indigenous peoples are being removed from their lands in the name of conservation, you know, in the name of protecting areas. And now we're not having access to our lifestyle systems in our lands. So all of those issues need to be acknowledged and put really in the front so that solutions that really benefit the whole Mother Earth start happening. Otherwise, we continue with being that stuck in those narratives, right? Rationalizing that in the name of, then we can continue the abuse.
Thank you, Sister. I think the way I'll respond to that question, dear Sister Naomi, is I think of whiteness as this planet terraforming principle, right? It's the flattening of the wilds, it's the clearing that seeks to dismiss the agency, the deep intelligence, the wild and promiscuous embodied grounding forces around us, and to reduce all of that to the individual, the myth of the individual, the story in this climate weathering. We've become the weathering bodies, the resource base for this machine that is flattening everything. So, of course, I think we already know that climate isn't just the weather. It's how we think. It's how we name ourselves. It's how we perform technology. It's how we travel. It's how we eat. It's how we make love. It's how we tell stories. It's all of this. And I think the invitation, the wisdom of chaos, I'm using those story elements, Yuria, that you've invited in. The invitation is to shapeshift, is to, in the words of Guattari, is to stand up and leave the couch, the psychotherapist's or the psychoanalyst's couch behind, that is preserving our individuality and coddling our minds into thinking that we are separate from the world we're trying to fix. This feels like the loss of white stability for me. It seems like we're storing this loss of stability. We just don't have the way to ritualize this loss. But there are lots of, from my vantage point, African elders and indigenous cosmological stories and accounts that follow the slaves and told the stories of capture. It seems like what you're inviting us to talk about, Naomi, is capture, where the ships, the slave ships that pulled close to Africa are now pulling close to the world, to the shores of the entire world. And we've reached a point of no return. So we need to listen to people like Earl Lovelace or C.L.R. James or Hortense Spillers or Fred Moulton, who say, maybe speaking truth to power is not the issue here. Maybe we're kind of, maybe even our struggle is part of the structure we're trying to upend. Maybe we need fugitive ways of addressing this crisis. And maybe grief is that ecstatic fugitivity that we're speaking about. Grief as art, grief as aesthetics, grief as vocation is not a question of safety for ourselves as much as it is a making sanctuary for this thing, this transformative agent that has come to us, namely grief. Yeah, I think I'll stop there. But how about we do this? There are questions coming in. Now, this isn't exactly framed as a context for responding to questions. The aesthetic isn't one of, I get it now. Now I understand. Because as Naomi said in the beginning, more data isn't the problem. More and more and more information doesn't seem to be working, right? So this isn't about getting it. This isn't about sensorial encounters. Even confusion can be a blessing here. But let's do this. Let's experiment with this to start things off. There are questions coming in. I will read it out. There are no guarantees of answers. Everyone listening, no answers here, just responses, just gestures. And if you feel called to respond to it, Naomi, Yuria, then please do. Let me take one. Is how do we prepare for the chaos? I resonate with Naomi's fear of cruelty. We must make community in our places to traverse and build the new. So how do we prepare for the chaos?
So the reason why the beauty of vulnerability that brings us into the real embodied need of others. Like, oh, I don't know, we don't know. So then we come together, right? Those moments of deep vulnerability, shared vulnerability, we realize we're actually much closer than we imagine. So let yourself be in the chaos, embrace the chaos, and embrace it as a place of possibility, as a place of unknowing, where life can emerge.
Yuria, come on, give us a little handle somewhere. So you're saying there's no certainty, nothing to hold within the chaos, nothing?
We can hold into life herself, into spirit herself, you know, which is what's animating the right action. That's why we need that moment of reflection and contemplation to really understand. We see life, the whole of cycles of nature that are talking about that process, that process of resting, that process of emerging, the process of blooming, and then calming and wilting and passing. The huge network you were saying by in the beginning, the mycelial network, you know, that connects all around, you know, the cosmic networks that connect us. So holding on to that, but perhaps also we need to let go of the holding itself, needing to let go of hope itself, you know, and allow us to really sense, really embody, let it feel through the body, the process of grief, because that's where the transformation will happen.
Thank you so very much, sister. Thank you. Naomi.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, letting go of hope is not the same as letting go of love. And that in these moments of chaos, right, you're saying prepare for the chaos. There's chaos everywhere, all over the place, and it's unevenly distributed. And what we know from disasters, you know, these staccato events, right, when any ability to deny, ignore is upended by a wildfire, a hurricane, a heat dome. Love, community, connection saves lives again and again and again. So coming back to what I was saying earlier, how do we fall? Do we fall holding each other or stabbing each other? How do we use the falling as an opportunity to, as you said in the question, how do we build community? And that's absolutely key. And to be a boring leftist, I also think we need to invest in non-market housing and public health care and food for all, because these things make us less likely that we turn on each other because we have less of a feeling of scarcity.
Yeah, I really love how then love is entering into our conversation, kind of like embracing the whole of the conversation.
Thank you so much, Naomi. And adding the leftist part to this was chef's kiss. There's a question, and I think it's a beautiful way to come to a plateau, is how do we deal with feelings of isolation that arise from living in a world/society? I live in the UK, says this person, that can feel majoritively in the dark about where we are with the climate emergency. And my partial response to that is that the philosophies, the feminisms, the indigenous ideas that nourish my work, there are always openings and cracks. Yuria said something about the spiral that produces molecular differences. Right? There are always little glimpses of novelty that might be pathological to modernity. My instigation is follow those feelings, follow those desires to where they might lead and experiment around it. Yeah, I'm kind of tired with
light metaphors, light comes into the crack. Endarkenment is what we're doing now, not enlightenment. It's where the loamy soil comes in. So where that leads, the crack is the invitation to lose our way. That's my partial response. There's other things I could say, but I wanted you both to speak to that. And maybe this is how we wrap things up, if there's no space for one more question.
Well, I'll go so that Yuria can close us out. Yes. So I was struck by the part of the question that talks about being in the UK and feeling that people are in the dark. I often hear this sort of, what do we do about the people who don't care? What do we do about the people who, you know, who are indifferent? And I think I would just say, don't buy it. I don't believe it is possible to not know, to not care about the scale of loss. It helps to not come at it from a space of, I need to make you care about something, and think about it more in the sense of, how do we open up space to know what we already know, to feel what we know. And if you're attached to a certain story and suddenly there's an event without a story for it, you're putty in the hands of tyrants who want to stick a really dangerous story in your head, right? And I think we can all think of examples like that. So this process of weaving different kinds of stories, resurfacing stories about colonialism and capitalism and whiteness attempted to exterminate, that's disaster preparation. That's more important than stockpiling toilet paper. That's really, really important. I just want to say thank you.
Sense of identities, the crack that you were talking about. Yes, let's now invite the possibilities of darkness, that chaos, that unknown. Thinking of crack that enters into the depths of Mother Earth.
Yes.
To find that well of medicine, that well of life. And also the crack that also symbolizes the beginning of rupture of what we know, you know, of the systems that we know. So rather than recurring to fundamental ideas or stories, no, rather stories that are participatory, intentional stories, you know, collective stories, which is why it's so important to be acknowledging, reckoning, and repairing the current identities, so that we don't keep perpetuating them. No, rather we feel empowered to intentionally create the stories of belonging that we're looking for, using that crack as the entering, or like the coming out of what possibilities are. And I also feel profoundly grateful for this time together, so generative, and that allow us to really welcome what we don't know and our not having the solutions yet, allowing the questions without the answers.
Thank you so much. It's just appropriate that grief, we started with grief, and somewhere along the line it became gratitude. And that's really holding grief well, I think. Thank you. Thank you both, Naomi, Yuria, for holding this space with us. And for everyone who has been listening, clock time says it's about time to, but African time says, nah. No, that's not how to think about time. Time is always beginning, right? Just because clock time says it ends here doesn't mean the inquiry doesn't continue. And this is just to let you know that you're not alone, that we are in this planetary conversation together. Let it spill. Take it to a party, take it to your community, to your neighborhood. You know, let's have these conversations and let them change us so that we might become different. All right. We'll see you in your dreams. Naomi will show up first and then, and then Yuria, but probably not. We'll see you soon. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of For the Wild. The music you heard today is by Sitka Sun and Michaela McVeigh, generously provided by the Long Road Society record label. Before the Wild is created by Ayana Young, Erica Ekram, Julia Jackson, Jackson Krupp, Evan Tenenbaum, and Jose Alejandro Rivera.
KBOO Portland. 90.7 FM on your dial. Up next is the Reggae Bobcast Show. I'm your host, Reggae Bob, and we've got 2 hours. A very, very special 93.7% of the show today is going to be about 1973. When you were born, when you graduated high school, when you graduated college.
Listener powered non-corporate community radio.
Don't ever get it twisted. I'm your host, Reggae Bob. We're so glad you're here tonight. That is a fan blowing in the background because it is 273 degrees in the station. Well, we got you. We feel it. So let's start here. From 1954, if you were born in 54, you graduated high school, chances are, in 1954. 1973, Stranger in Paradise. This is the Four Aces.
My hand, I'm a stranger inside.